In his bestseller, Beethoven, The Man Who Freed Music, first published in 1929, the poet and essayist Robert Haven Schaufler pulled a parade of opinions of Beethoven's Fifth from a pool of straw men. And this is Schaufler writing now. To Brown, it may signify a fierce conflict with a sexual obsession. To Jones, a desperate campaign against an inferiority complex. To Robinson, an old-fashioned pitched battle a la Paradise Lost between the forces of good and evil. To a victim of hysteria, it may depict a war between sanity and bedlam. To a neurasthenic, a struggle between those two mutually exclusive objectives, to be or not to be. To an evolutionist, it may bring up the primordial conflict of fire and water, of man and beast, of civilization with savagery, of land with sea. This sort of mutable celebrity had already long surrounded the symphony. Beethoven's Fifth, the Symphony in C Minor, Opus 67, might not be the greatest piece of music ever written. Even Beethoven himself preferred his Third Symphony, the Eroica. But it must be the greatest great piece ever written, a figure on which successive mantles of greatness have ever more inevitably fit with tailored precision. And its iconic opening is a large part of that, short enough to remember and portentous enough to be memorable, seeming to unlock the symphony's meaning but leaving its mysteries temptingly out of reach, saying something but admitting nothing. This is a book about Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. More specifically, it is a book about the opening notes of that symphony, and more specifically than that, it is a book about what people have heard in those notes throughout history and how history itself has affected what was heard. It is, then, history viewed through the forced perspective of one piece of music, though, to be fair, there is only a handful of pieces of music that could yield a comparable view, and most of them are by Beethoven. And even within the subject's limited parameters, it is hardly a comprehensive history. Any writing on Beethoven is an exercise in selection, and the selection says at least as much, if not more, about the writer's obsessions as it does about Beethoven. This is only one possible path through the biography of the Fifth Symphony. There could be many others. To say that a piece of music has meaning is to say that it is susceptible to discussions of meaning, and by that standard, Beethoven's Fifth is easily one of the most meaningful pieces ever written. The number and variety of the interpretations assigned to the Fifth, the creativity with which the piece has been invoked in support of countless, often contradictory causes, artistic, philosophical, or political, all of this is a tribute to its amorphous power. It is also, on the side of the interpreters, a testament to human creativity, ingenuity, and folly. The vaunted universality of Beethoven's achievement encompasses the sublime and the ridiculous. Not that he didn't try to warn us. In 1855, an unknown writer felt compelled to make a handwritten addition to a copy of Anton Schindler's biography of Beethoven, and he told this story. Something about the beginning of the C minor symphony. Many men were disturbed over the beginning of the Fifth. One of them asked Beethoven about the reason for the unusual opening and its meaning. Beethoven answered, "The beginning sounds and means, you are too dumb."
Certainly not too dumb at all is our guest, Matthew Guerrieri, G-U-E-R-R-I-E-R-I. And he was reading for us from his wonderful book, meditation, collection, provocation, the first four notes, Beethoven's Fifth and the Human Imagination, published this year by Alfred A. Knopf, praised right on the back by our good friend and good friend of this program and station, Alex Ross. And, well, you already hear just from the preface a plan, a summation, a conclusion, an introduction, and even a demur, that more can be said and different things can be said, even though your point is, in part, that so many different things can be said. And what does that mean? Yes?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. It's one of the things about Beethoven's Fifth is it is so prototypically what we think of as, you know, a canonical piece of classical music. And once you start to scratch the surface, you realize a lot of that reputation is just the fact that so many people have been able to say so many different and, in fact, at times wildly contradictory things about it and somehow, at least rhetorically, plausibly make it stick. So I think that's the thing about the piece is it's combines that sort of very amorphous vision of abstract music where it's just it's the sound and nothing else, but it's coming at you with sort of the sort of rhetorical power that Beethoven was able to muster on his more emphatic days. And so it feels so much like it should be saying something, but to you know, every single person who listens to it, it's saying something just a little bit different. And it's been doing that for so long that now it's just sort of, not only is it firmly entrenched in our idea of classical music, it is in so many ways the model for what we think of when we just talk about, sort of without thinking, a great piece of music.
And I should say, too, welcome to Matthew Guerrieri.
Hello.
Glad to be here. Thank you for that summation of the summation and reintroduction, too, because here we are with this piece that the piece as a whole, but we're going to do as you do, the opening of the piece, and we'll talk about the whys of that, of course. Everybody has heard it. Most people have a response, and the responses are so different.
Yes.
And that, I mean, and different, okay, we a big name this year and for the last 150 years or so would be Richard Wagner. And most people have an opinion about Wagner. And those opinions usually fall into one of two choices: love him, hate him. Then, of course, within the love him, there are all kinds of analyses. It's religious. But the main feeling is Wagner. Whereas with Beethoven, it can be anything, and you start, I believe this is from a comic book at the beginning of the preface.
Oh yeah, a webcomic, yes.
A webcomic, Questionable Content by Jeff, J-E-P-H, I think he says Jakes, but I'm not
Jeff
sure.
Jakes.
Yeah, J-A-C-Q-U-E-S. Martin, what about you? Do you have any big nostalgia-inducing songs? Hannelore, Beethoven's Fifth reminds me of Canada. I don't know why, I've never been to Canada. So, I mean, the ability to provoke something, and given when the piece is written, and given the last couple hundred years, those provoked range from Marx to Adorno to the Allies to the Nazis to Thoreau to Emerson to every Daffy Duck, right?
I mean, yeah.
Are we leaving any?
Everybody.
Nobody is left out. So that gives you, as a self-described Victorian collector, a lot to rummage through and a lot to think about.
Yeah,
as well.
It's an awful lot, and I do not pretend to have come even close to reaching the end, the bottom of the box of Beethoven interpretations. I think one of the most important things about the piece is it gets in right at the ground floor of people starting to just think about music in this way, to think about music as something that will provoke a response, to think about music as something akin to a philosophical argument. And Beethoven was at the creation for that, and it was really, you know, the German Romantics who adopted Beethoven's Fifth in order to start to promote that idea of music. The way I think of it is the whole cliche of music picking up where language leaves off, which
right.
We think of as just sort of a platitude now, but that's a very specifically romantic idea from the early 1800s, and so right about the time when that idea was starting to come forth, the Romantics were looking around for some piece of music that they could use to sort of promote this idea, to illustrate it, and E.T.A. Hoffmann was the one who seized on Beethoven's Fifth. So in a way, it was almost, you know, just the luck of being in the right place at the right time to get in on this now 200-year tradition of interpreting music in that way. And again, because it was one of the first, whenever people start to interpret other pieces of music, this is sort of the model of the thinking that they try to apply to other pieces of music throughout history.
There's a lot of chicken and egg in that and in the
yes.
book and in life.
Yeah.
But how much do you think that it was luck or coincidence, and how much of it is, to use another created term that has become platitudinous, zeitgeist? I mean, how much of it was that Beethoven was making music at the same time that people were thinking about what music, poetry, visual art might be in that way, or is it a collision? Or
it's hard to tell. Beethoven's philosophy, what we know about it, was very much the philosophy of the Enlightenment. That's what he was brought up in. He had tutors as a child who were very much promoting Enlightenment ideas, and so that's sort of what Beethoven knew, and the Romantics were very much reacting against that. And In as far as the Romantics were promoting Beethoven as a great composer, Beethoven was a savvy enough person to recognize that this was a good thing from the point of view of publicity, and he went along with it, and he encouraged it, and he knew what people were saying about him. But as to whether he really bought into it, it's hard to tell. He didn't really talk about it that much. A lot of what he writes certainly has the flavor of Romanticism, but it's also... he was already sort of pushing the boundaries of music just because that's who he was. Even long before the Romantics were, you know, talking about his music, he was already doing that just because he was that kind of a person and that kind of a composer. And so whether or not the sort of acceleration of the Romantic zeitgeist just gave him more and more permission to do that as his career went on, it's certainly a possibility. But it is a very tricky thing to try and figure out where, you know, what came first. So. Right.
But you really couldn't have a better template for the 205 years of thinking about Beethoven than Beethoven, in that here's a guy who is protean, creates, makes things new, has knowledge of and attention to history, believes in universalism, yet is totally separate from society for the most part, is capable of expressing himself in language with great precision and meaning, and yet chooses not to explain his music. So he sort of is the prophet of himself in a way, in that you can have somebody who says the music is empty and permanent at its core, and it's deeply meaningful at its core, and it's beautiful. I mean, you can have all of that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the other thing to point out is that the whole idea that you can draw on all the Beethoven's personality and Beethoven's life in order to interpret his music, that starts with Beethoven.
Right.
Beethoven's
the
first composer who's important enough for people to vacuum up every detail about his life and start doing biographies about it. And so, again, if you go forward to Wagner, somebody like Wagner, one of the reasons it's so hard for us to separate out Wagner's musical achievement from the fact that a lot of his personal life was, and his personal opinions were, extremely unsavory. The reason we have so much trouble separating those out is because of the example of Beethoven, because Beethoven, it was so easy to put it all together, and the more you knew about Beethoven, it seemed like the more you knew about his music, which is something that has been both very persistent in musical interpretation, and also in a lot of cases very troublesome, because it tends to sort of distract us from really what's going on musically. I think Wagner's a great example of that, because, you know, Wagner's music is the best part of Wagner.
No doubt about it.
And it's an amazing achievement, but because of the example of Beethoven, because of that way of thinking, it's just so hard to get away from the fact that there were other very much not good parts of Wagner that now we feel like we have to deal with in order to appreciate the music. And so it's a very uneasy fit in that regard. And certainly just because, you know, Wagner's such this towering figure. But without the example of Beethoven, maybe we would have applied that example to Wagner just because he was a very similar personality. But maybe, you know, we would not be having that trouble. We could just say the music is great, we don't care about the person. And we don't need to worry about that in order to appreciate the achievement.
The other thing we can do is sort of do that in reverse, too, and that is the important technological shifts. They're not completed, but they start between their two compositional lives. So imagine Beethoven if we had photography, because we have plenty of people who drew, sketched, and painted Beethoven in his life, unlike Bach, in his lifetime. And imagine if there had been cameras, he would have been like Lincoln. There would have been 2,000 million photos of Beethoven, especially because he lived in the big city.
He was a celebrity in his own time.
And if we had telegraphy and everything else, we would have been getting gossip news in British and American newspapers. Herr Beethoven seen at, you know, the way we did with Wagner. So.
And as it was, we did get something like that, only much, much, much delayed, to the point where towards the end of his life, the Handel and Haydn Society in Boston, which had just been founded, actually informally sent word to Beethoven that they wanted to commission a piece from him.
Right.
So the fame had actually reached across the ocean at that point.
We're talking with Matthew Guerrieri about his book, The First Four Notes, Beethoven's Fifth and the Human Imagination. And as we go through the book, we can't cover every point. There's only a 23, as I counted it, or 24-page bibliography. That's not even the notes, and it's in pica type. But the book is flowing and beautifully written and narrative. It is not just a miscellany. A miscellany would be interesting, but these miscellaneous things have been taken together, woven together by theme, and then roughly chronologically, you take us through from Beethoven. We have revolutions, fates, infinities, associations, secret remedies, earthquakes, and, of course, the contemporary world, samples, and then this wonderful preface and epilogue on either side. But maybe we can walk through at least some of the themes and people. And the one who gets us going on what you've just been talking about, of course, is Anton Schindler, because here is Beethoven's secretary, confidant-ish, recorder of things. And as you say, they're everything. We wouldn't know what we knew if we didn't have what we know if we didn't have him. But what we have from him, we don't know, or we didn't know what to trust and what made sense and what was right and what was just made up.
Yes, it's a lot of what we know about Beethoven is because of Schindler, and a lot of what we know from Schindler we don't know, because it's he was Beethoven's first biographer. He was with Beethoven on a day-to-day basis for the last several years of his life, and he is a wildly unreliable observer, we have come to realize. He would make up stories. He hung on to the conversation books, which are sort of the books Beethoven would use when his hearing went, so other people could write questions to him and then he could respond. And he was the steward of those after Beethoven's death. He destroyed a lot of them. He forged some of them. And so it's been very much a mixed bag. But I think, you know, one of the things, if you get away from sort of the fact that it's historically incredibly frustrating to try and separate out what's the truth and what's not the truth in Schindler, you have to give Schindler credit, because he really was a very good myth maker. He knew what would make a great story, and he knew what would make a plausible story in light of the way that people were already thinking about Beethoven even by the time he died. And so, while as a historian I just want to shake Schindler and yell at him, Beethoven's reputation is in large part due to the fact that there is this huge gray area there. And the greatest example of that is the one story that most people know about the Fifth Symphony, which is that supposedly Beethoven said the opening of the symphony represents fate knocking at the door, which is a wonderful poetic image, which my own opinion is that Schindler made it up whole cloth. Even if he didn't, it was something Beethoven would have said many, many years after he wrote the piece. But at the same time, because it's sort of not this definite quote, it's not this documentary evidence thing we have in Beethoven's own hand, it becomes this trope that people are able to sort of very freely adapt to whatever interpretive purpose they're dealing with at the time. And it was sort of used as a way to get the idea of the Fifth Symphony into a lot of places that maybe a more definite story or a less poetic story wouldn't have. So you cannot deny Schindler his role in creating Beethoven the myth. You can certainly scold Schindler for his role in not creating or leaving a decent enough record of Beethoven the actual human being. But a lot of Schindler's myth-making is very much in that romantic vein. It's very much designed to match with the romantic idea of Beethoven. So I think one of the reasons that the romantic Beethoven was the one that really sort of piggybacked itself into the culture so well was in large part because of that sort of myth-making that Schindler was doing.
But at the same time, though, as you've said, and you have a wonderful phrase that I'll probably get wrong now in the book, that an entire wing of the monument of Beethoven scholarship is erected on sand.
It
by
is,
Schindler.
Yes, it is. So, it is, and really, it's a lot of it. It took many years to undo, and a lot of it was undone by a man named Alexander Wheelock Thayer, mm-hmm. who was an American. He was a Bostonian, and he became so obsessed with Beethoven that he actually went and lived in Germany and started compiling really the documentary evidence to do a proper biography, which eventually became several volumes and is sort of really much more reliable. But that didn't start to happen until the later part of the 19th century. And by that time, a lot of the stories that had been seeded by Schindler and people like him had really just taken hold. And we will never get rid of the fate knocking at the door story.
Right.
It will always come with a footnote that says, this is from Schindler, so take it with as large a grain of salt as you can find, but it will always be there.
I just wish we could remove both it and contrasting references, that is, when a program annotator writes in Symphony X, reacting to Beethoven's fate knocking at the door, Prokofiev, or whatever.
Yes.
You know, imagine if we could just wave a wand and take all those out of program notes.
Yeah. Although, to be fair, you know,
in their minds, that's
in their minds, maybe
right.
It was. Maybe the opening of Mahler's Fifth was, you know, him knocking at the door even faster and louder, or, you know, all the other pieces that sort of pick that up as a motive, or seem to pick it up as a motive. And it becomes sort of a cultural artifact to play with.
Right.
And even if you don't believe it, it becomes an idea that composers play with, and that poets play with, and that writers play with. And the fact that it probably doesn't have much, if any, basis in truth stops mattering after a while, at least from a cultural standpoint.
We come to some of that in the late 19th and early 20th century in a moment, but let's look through some things before that. Beethoven, German, who came to Vienna and made really his permanent home, although never had a permanent home in Vienna, but moved a lot. But there's Beethoven looking, though, often from before the Fifth on, and then being embraced by, and a big part of what you talk about in the earlier parts of the book, Paris and France, that this is where politics are moving. There's stasis in Vienna, and that's partially what enables musicians to be able to get their work done, but that's where stuff is happening. And of course, there's the mental romance with Napoleon, there's the Eroica, there are other works like that. But then there's also the way the Napoleonists and their successors use, or are among the first to use, this work.
Yes. Well, it's interesting because Napoleon was his armies.
I said Napoleonists on purpose for those listeners who are right now writing a letter to the editor, because a Bonapartist is a follower of Napoleon. I mean Napoleon and all the backs and forths that came after him for the next 30, 40, 50 years.
Yeah, Napoleon's armies were constantly, you know, going into the Holy Roman Empire and occupying and bombing cities and whatnot. And actually, there's a way of looking at a lot of sort of the romantic idea of music and the romantic idea of Beethoven as sort of a response to that. Certainly, E.T.A. Hoffmann, who wrote this enormous review of the Fifth Symphony that was published in the most important German language musical magazine of its time, and it really made sort of the romantic reputation of the piece. Hoffmann was someone who had been for many years a refugee from the Napoleonic Wars. He had been getting pushed from city to city to city, and he had certainly seen what it was like to live under siege. And so there's this, you kind of start to get this idea that this whole idea of music elevating you out of the world and into some realm of the sublime is not just sort of this fanciful philosophical idea, but it's really a very strong desire on the part of these people, somebody like Hoffmann, who's a very sensitive person, living under these conditions and just looking for any escape that they can find. So this idea of music as escapism, which is how we would characterize it today, it's slightly more high-minded version in the Romantics writing, but it is very much, all of this stuff is coming out of wartime. I think that's a big part of sort of where this is coming, and to see the switch over sort of from that Beethoven to sort of the nationalist Beethoven, mm-hmm. which particularly happens in Germany across the 19th century. And, you know, as Beethoven becomes more and more just this German national hero, to the point where there was a story that went around that prior to the 1870 battle at Sedan between Prussia and France, mm-hmm. that there was a story, not exactly true, that Bismarck had actually basically called for a performance of Beethoven's Fifth mm-hmm. by command, a command performance to sort of get him charged up for the battle. And that story comes back into circulation during World War I. Right. And so the transition of it is very unusual because it has a lot to do with the fact that a lot of people sort of were trying to claim Beethoven as a revolutionary figure, but it's not exactly a good fit. A lot of people were trying to claim him as sort of an aristocratic and conservative figure. That doesn't really quite fit either. He sort of falls in between. The phrase I always like is a phrase from Maynard Solomon, who's the great Beethoven biographer, and, right. and he characterizes Beethoven's politics as liberty and fraternity, but not necessarily equality. And I think that's a pretty good summation of it, in that he was very sympathetic to sort of people who talked a lot about freedom, and he was very sympathetic to sort of rhetoric about brotherhood and that sort of thing, but he was not necessarily ready to cast aside the whole system of an hierarchy of the aristocracy and the monarchy. A very interesting part of the Fifth is how much, the Fifth Symphony in particular, and a lot of middle period Beethoven, is how much the sheer style of it owes to examples that come out of the French Revolution. Because the French Revolution had its own style of music. The revolutionary government commissioned composers to write pieces for these big public propaganda festivals. And that music was widely known because they published it. They paid to publish it. We know that Beethoven knew about this music because he knew the French ambassador to Vienna, who had brought a complete set of it with him. Mm-hmm. And we also know that he was a great admirer of a lot of the composers of that era and of that scene, including especially Cherubini,
right.
who is one of probably the one who's best remembered today.
And who was Italian by birth, but who lived for 60-some years in Paris.
In Paris, and was one of this stable of composers that the government turned to. And if you compare Beethoven's Fifth with the music that was written for these fêtes, as they were called, it's strikingly similar style. It's, mm-hmm. it's all short, little digestible motives repeated. The harmonic language is very sort of sturdy and very basic and very powerful, and there's a lot of rhythmic drive to it. And in fact, there are a couple of pieces from that repertoire that even seem to foreshadow the Fifth, in that they use the same rhythmic motive in very much the same way that Beethoven uses it in the first movement of the Fifth Symphony. And so the question is, how much is this piece, this Fifth Symphony, meant to be heard as sort of in that style? And if so, what does it mean? Is it meant to be really a revolutionary statement? Is it Beethoven just recognizing a good rhetorical style when he hears it and borrowing it for his own purposes? And we don't really know. But I think it made it easier to be adopted as sort of an example of revolutionary music, but because it's not quite specific enough, it also made it very easy to be adopted as just sort of a general sort of martial statement mm-hmm. for charging up the troops as well.
Right.
And so again, it's sort of that vagueness at the source that makes it able to be adapted in so many different directions.
Whatever his intention, unlike the intention at least of the commissioners of the French Revolutionary Music,
yeah.
Whatever Beethoven's intention was, he did write something that had a catchy rhythm and could be excerpted. And we'll come to that whole notion of fragmentation as well. A couple of people who thought about these things from the other side, who weren't writing music but were hearing it and were thinking about it, and one at least who was thinking, some might say, more about equality than equality and fraternity than liberty, Hegel and Marx. And you introduce them, or they introduce themselves into the narrative as well.
Yeah. Hegel does not write very much about music.
Right. Not, it's more Hegelian.
Hegelian ways of thinking are so important to music history. They were adopted very quickly. The whole idea of musical progress, the idea right. that a given generation's music supersedes the previous generation's music. These are all Hegelian ways of thinking, and in a way we're just so accustomed to it that it's hard to even remember that it has an origin, but it has an origin in this very complicated philosophy that Hegel was doing. Beethoven sort of gets worked into this Hegelian view of music history fairly early on by a different Marx, a man named Adolf Bernhard Marx, who was is actually a lawyer, but he was also great musical enthusiast and wrote a lot about music. When we talk about sonata form, that was something that Marx came up with. And he came up with it by studying the music of Beethoven. So sort of what we think of a sonata allegro form was sort of a formalization of Beethoven's compositional practice, which of course he had learned from Mozart and Haydn and that generation. But what's interesting about how Marx sort of puts it into code and makes the rules for it is he makes up the rules, and now this is about 20 years after Beethoven's death, and so it's in many cases up to 30 or 40 years after the pieces he's talking about were written, and so he's making up these rules for music going forward, and he's setting them up in such a way that Beethoven has already gone past them. Because this is the idea of Beethoven being the exceptional figure and the idea that he would already have vaulted past sort of the norms is puts him sort of in a very privileged place in a Hegelian way.
Right.
Because that's Hegel's sole idea is you have these intractable, you have these sort of ways that society is set up and it brings about problems and conflicts that are intractable until you're able to sort of vault forward and move into the next stage of history. And then if you keep going far enough, you reach a stage of history, which he called the absolute, which is pretty much equivalent to some sort of union with the divine. But these ideas get worked into music history largely through Beethoven's example. And when you start looking at sort of then the advent of communism and how they used music and how they viewed music and mm-hmm. sort of music that was coming out of that, those sorts of societies, it's interesting because Marx is sort of flipping Hegel on Hegel's philosophy on its head. Because Marx's whole idea is that the conflicts are not something that you move past. You can't, in fact, really the sign of progress is that the conflicts are now really, really clear. So now we can fight it out. And right. and it's also the whole idea of the materialistic conception of history, which is that you know, it's not something about the divine. We're not aiming for some absolute. It's very much about economy and class and things that happen in this world, and that's the engine behind history. And so if you start to look at sort of Beethoven's reputation, both as a revolutionary figure in the 19th century as communism sort of starts to advance, and then also in the 20th century in the Soviet Union and other communist nations, that's really when you start to see the focus of the entire symphony shift from the finale to the first movement.
Mm-hmm.
Because the finale is the resolution. The finale is it's this big, grand, loud resolution catharsis to all the conflict that's come beforehand. And at the premiere of the symphony, and for many years after, that was considered really the most amazing part of the symphony, was the fact that it started in minor, but then you get this finale that's in a major key. The minor key comes back just for a little bit, but then it is banished by this huge celebration. I think it was Cosima Wagner who called it a lot of celebration about nothing, which is kind of not a bad description of
right.
what it is, because it's really so insistent that after a while you start to sort of wonder, it's like, well, why are you really hammering this so hard? But it's really once the whole materialist conception of history comes into play, then you start to see a lot more emphasis on really the first movement being the most remarkable of part of the symphony,
right,
because it's the whole idea that it's this short motive, but that it is able to be built into this drama of struggle and this drama of conflict and just the amount of power he's able to get out of that before it even gets to the second, third, and fourth movements that people really start to focus on. And so I think that's one way, at least in my mind, that by, you know, at many times remove these grand ideas about philosophy and history get trickled down into music appreciation mm-hmm. ways, and that mm-hmm. just, you know, now it's like, I would guess more people would recognize the opening of the Fifth Symphony than the opening of the finale of the Fifth
right.
Symphony.
Right.
And that would not have been the case necessarily in the first few decades after its premiere. And so that's a shift that I think possibly comes about because of shifts in attitudes about history and shifts in attitudes about the way societies advance or don't advance.
So in addition to doing so in a historical, philosophical way, Marx may have turned Hegel on his head musicologically, whether Hegel
a little
set
bit,
out
yeah.
to be in that field or not. We're speaking with Matthew Guerrieri about his book, The First Four Notes, Beethoven's Fifth and the Human Imagination. I'm Andrew Patner. You're listening to Critical Thinking on WFMT 98.7 in Chicago and WFMT.com anywhere around the world. Materialism is there and attaches itself to Beethoven. Jumping about a bit and jumping ahead and jumping across the ocean again to the Boston area, transcendentalism. We know that as with a number, that's a topic for another book perhaps, writers who think about art and nature and so on, but who don't really get into music. But Emerson certainly recognized that this was something he had to tangle with, and he knew that whether they were listening to his sermons or reading his essays, people knew these notes.
Yeah, yeah. And the New England Transcendentalism was really, it was very much an adaptation of German Romanticism. It was an attempt to sort of get German Romanticism and the ideas behind it into some sort of, you know, into American society. Beethoven probably actually came into it via a really remarkable figure, a woman named Margaret Fuller, who was in many ways by far the most intelligent and keen of the transcendentalists.
Mm-hmm.
And she was probably the one who introduced Beethoven, because she was the one who was really most conversant in German Romanticism at the source, and so she would have known about Beethoven. A lot of the other transcendentalists certainly recognized Beethoven's greatness, but almost only by reputation. You know, Emerson does not really talk about music in any sort of specifically musical way, but he knew enough to recognize that Beethoven was an important figure. And in fact, I think a lot of it was just, you know, just Beethoven's music and just Beethoven, the idea of Beethoven the man could get you a long ways into German Romanticism before you actually had to start dealing with the actual philosophy between German Romanticism,
right,
which is kind of difficult to deal with and very difficult to put your finger on. But really, that's the transcendentalists are the start of what really became a fairly robust cult of Beethoven in the United States. The man who was most responsible for it was a guy named John Sullivan Dwight,
mm-hmm.
who started off as a Unitarian minister, like many, many, many of the transcendentalists. It was one of the main recruiting tools for transcendentalism. He didn't make it as a minister, but he kept going with transcendentalism. He was one of the members of Brook Farm, which was a utopian commune that some transcendentalists started on the outskirts of Boston, which only lasted for a few years, but was almost legendary.
Fuller was very involved with, and
Fuller visited very frequently.
Hawthorne
Emerson
writes his either description, satire, or moral lesson, the Blithedale Romance about Brook Farm,
is very much a portrait of Brook Farm. Emerson also used to visit Brook Farm
right.
on a regular, he'd come over from Concord on a regular basis. And Dwight came to Beethoven quite early, and he was at the first performances of the Fifth Symphony in Boston, which were in the 1840s. And what's really interesting about Dwight is that he ended up becoming one of the leading music critics in the United States in the 19th century, really the first person who can, you know, call that a profession. That's what he did for a living after a while. And it's tremendously influential in the way people thought about music in America. And yet, it's sort of his opinions never changed. It's his opinion of the Fifth is particularly revealing of this, because when he saw that concert in the 1850s, he wrote a review of it for, it was for a very short-lived Transcendental magazine, but he wrote a review of it. And then later in life, he started his own magazine, which is called Dwight's Journal of Music, which was very widely read and which was tremendously influential. And one of the first things he does when he starts his own magazine is he reprints that same review from the 1840s. And then from that point forward, whenever the subject of Beethoven's Fifth would come up, he'd just direct the reader back to the reprint. He'd say, if you want to know, you know, if you want to know what I would think, you can just go back to this issue.
Which becomes like his statement of belief.
It is. It's very much. He made up his mind very early on, and he was very dedicated to keeping his mind made up for the rest of his life. When he finally gives up publishing Dwight's Journal of Music, and this is now moving forward to the 1880s, it's mainly because Wagnerism and Wagner have become sort of the fad, and he can't understand it. And he just admits it as much. He just says straight out, it's like, if this is what music is, then I can't write about this. I can't make sense of this. Then I'm done. And he stops publishing. And so what's really interesting is if you just follow Dwight, if you follow him as he goes from, you know, this no-name, aspiring transcendentalist all the way to this person who's this great figure in American musical discourse and promoting the founding of permanent orchestras, including the Boston Symphony Orchestra. The founding of that was in large part due to him constantly haranguing Boston audiences that they should have this, and it's a great thing. And by that time, he starts off as a complete radical, just a completely, you know, far out radical, and Beethoven is his music. And by the end of his life, he's a complete conservative, and Beethoven is still his music. So you kind of follow that thread, and you can see Beethoven going from this very radical import and really the cutting edge of music to really just the center of the classical music canon and its most conservative tendencies. And you can just through this one man's career, you can see how it happens. And I think that's one of the most fascinating things to me about researching the book, was just following that path.
And it comes alive very much, all of these individuals, and they are, many of them start off in other fields. I don't just mean other humanistic fields, but they are engineers and bankers and lawyers and so on, who become, well, music really mattered in their worlds, and they helped to make it matter more for those folks around them or following them or who they harangued into following them. That brings us not even halfway, because we still haven't hit 1900, but we're having such a good time with this, and it is so fascinating. And I think, don't worry, there will be plenty left in the book when we're done. But I want to carry this over to a second part, and we're going to wrap up our first of two discussions now, the first four notes, Beethoven's Fifth and the Human Imagination. Matthew Guerreri, thank you so much for part one.
Thank you very much.
Music that we heard at the top of the show, a collage of the first four notes, well, each twice, so the first eight notes of the Fifth Symphony of Beethoven, taken from versions regarded by Matthew Guerreri. 1913, Arthur Nikisch, the Berlin Philharmonic. 1968, Glenn Gould, solo piano. 1970, Pierre Boulez and the New Philharmonia. Boulez's only Beethoven recording, quite hard to find. We brought it to you from an LP. Carlos Kleiber, famous Vienna 1975 recording. John Elliott Gardner and his Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique from 1995. And that great musical figure, Walter Murphy, 1976, a fifth of Beethoven. We'd like to thank, of course, Matthew Guerreri for being our guest this week and next, Eric Arunas for recording this program, Matt DeStefano for putting the programs together with us and making them sound great.
We'd also like to thank Samuel Galloway for his assistance, Tony Va, and Alex Ross. We thank our funders, Alphawood Foundation, Dick and Susie Kiphart, and other friends of this program. Let us know what you thought about this or any of our other programs. Drop us a line at RENTAP, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P, at AOL.com. Chime in at WFMT.com or visit the WFMT Facebook page and let us know what you thought. WFMT.com/critical thinking is where you can hear this or any of our other programs on the always free Critical Thinking podcast. Matthew Guerrieri will be back with us next week for part two of this conversation. We go out now with the full first movement in the Boulez version, shall we say, of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.
Thank you.